You amazing people out there, and welcome to the Amazing Action Comics podcast, where we are all about independent comics. I'm one of your hosts, Angel, with John Pepe.
How's it going, Angel?
It is going, brother. All right, listen, I timed that freaking intro. It's almost a minute. I have to. I mean, it's 2024. We can't have people wasting.
But you,
we do 1 week, 52 minutes. That's an hour of their life.
You worked so hard recording every part of that. Yeah, all those ha's and claps, that's all Angel.
Do you know what's funny, though, is that I'm like the first person, so I love going to the movies. And at like the AMC Theater, you know when they have their intros?
Mm-hmm.
And they have them run for like 6 months to a year. I'm the first one, like 3 weeks in, that's just gacking and throwing popcorn at the screen to say, shut up, Nicole Kidman. I know why I'm coming to the movies. So I think that's what people are going to eventually do when they keep hearing the same intro over and over. All right, I'm going off on a tangent. So, yeah, guys, welcome to another episode. Actually, this is special because we've got Indie Creator Spotlight today. We spoke about it earlier. Obviously, that we're going to have a special guest on. His name is Dennis Robinson. He is the head of High Head Studios and has a book that he's, you know, written, and we had a chance to read and go through, and he's got a Kickstarter coming up. So we're going to pop him in here and see if we can get him in trouble of some kind. Bam!
You guys have never listened to my podcast, so it'd take a lot to get me into trouble.
Now, I was reading, you have a D&D podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah.
See, I didn't want to open up that can of worms because I played D&D for so many years. And it's funny because I don't know if you guys know the actor Donald Faison. He was on Scrubs. I think one of his big movies was Waiting to Exhale. I grew up with him. I played D&D with him.
What?
As a teenager, yeah. We're not in communication now, so it's not a I'm not throwing out any names there, but
sure.
Yeah, we played D&D to the wee hours of the morning. I remember going, because I grew up in Hell's Kitchen, and there was a Manhattan Plaza, which was like on 40-something street, 43rd street, right like a block and a half away was like this market that it was open like 24 hours, and we would go like at 2 o'clock in the morning to get these dollar like meat sandwiches just for a break, and then go back and then play till like 6 o'clock in the morning. It was crazy, crazy. But yeah, I don't want to go down the D&D podcast. But it's fantastic. Fair. Wait, what's your favorite character to play? Or are you the DM?
So my internet title that was lovingly given to me by the other players on the podcast is the world's most okayest DM. So most of the time I'm the DM. We do Patreon episodes each month, okay. And sometimes I get to be a player. And I almost always go barbarian because spellcasters just give me a headache, and barbarians just smash.
See, I went the other direction. I always played sort of like either a cleric or a cleric assassin.
Okay.
I always played a female. For some reason, I always got my way. So it's all good. Yeah, we've assassinated plenty of people. What's the highest level? I know, John, I'm sorry, but we're just going on this.
You said we weren't going, and then you're like, we're not going. But by the way, here's a question.
What's the highest level character you've ever had?
So I would say the highest level character I ever had was probably 12. So growing up, our campaigns just didn't last that long because life would happen. And then you know how it goes. You play for a while, and then one person misses a session, and then you don't play again for 10 years.
Yep.
For the podcast, it's different because every season is a completely different setting. So they almost never get over level 10. The current season, the setting is SCP. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all. But basically, it's like modern day. It's like X-Files on crack.
Yep.
And so it's set in a normal universe, so there's not really any classes. Also, no one should ever get attached to any of the characters, because it's like a meat grinder. They're going to die. Like sometimes they have to bring like five or six characters with them to a session, because
I had stacks of characters. Yes. So our DM was not nice. If you made level seven, that was a miracle. back in the day.
Now,
we would play half of my childhood was D&D, just hours and hours and hours. And all my characters are dead. I should be
Warms my heart to see that high schools these days have like after school programs where like they'll open up the cafeteria and like you bring, sometimes they supply the snacks, and literally the kids just play D&D for like 3-4 hours.
Dude, and it goes into college, because I took my daughter on a college tour, and the girl that was taking us on the tour was the head of the D&D club in that college. I was like,
nice.
Holy crap, what a small world. All right, yeah, we're going off on a tangent. I'm sorry.
Can I say one more D&D thing? Totally. So you said that your DM is cruel. I am also cruel. We have a house rule, because we're called botched. So they roll a lot of ones. Okay. If you roll a one, I roll a D100, the higher the number, the worse it is. And if you roll if I roll a 91 to 95, I take a limb permanently. So I have a body die that literally tells me which limb I take.
And that's fantastic.
If I roll a 96 to 100 or a 69, because 69 counts as 100, then it's permadeath, just like instantaneous. You die a horrible, grotesque death. Like, we've had people literally like, I forget. Can I curse on this show?
Yeah. You're good.
Oh, okay. Literally had people like shit their guts out, like literally to death. So yeah.
Yeah, it's like John. John, did you play D&D?
So yeah, we've covered this. I never played, but I was always fascinated with source books. So I love the source books. So I'm familiar with like the lore and yeah. But it was even less D&D, but like more other properties, you know, like the James Bond role playing game, the DC Marvel.
There's a million of them these days.
But I love source books. I always thought that was so fascinating. But yeah, because of comics and all the acting that I was doing growing up, and then of course, like, you know, wrestling for 4 years and stuff like that, never had time for it. Never really carved out that time to get into it. But
excuse us.
No. I love it. I think it's fantastic, and I love people get excited about it. And yeah.
Yeah, no, it's bringing back all the trauma. I remember like one night, I don't know how we got our hands on a wish, and those are always traps. And I just remember spending countless hours on just the wording on how to, you know, ask for that wish.
Sure.
Because
gotta be careful.
It mattered. Yep. It really mattered. I mean, you asked for all the gold in the world and you would have it, and it would just sit on top of you and you'd be dead. So it had to be words. Like, I remember just every single word, and it didn't matter. I still died at the end. It was all good.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. All right. So a D&D podcast called Botched. Is that right?
Botched, a D&D podcast. That's right.
Fantastic. We're going to put that in the link so that people who can want to know more about that will get it. But we're here to talk about you and your book. But before we get into your book, let's get into a little bit of background. Comics. When did you get into comics? Like, what was your very first comic read, if any? Because you'd be the first one, if anything, that, you know, wrote a comic that never read a comic.
So I wasn't big into comics, but I could tell you the first comic I read, I don't remember the title of it, but I remember it was Wolverine versus like, it was sort of like a white werewolf, but it wasn't. There was like a little girl who was like also a cyborg. I forget. I was reading it in the grocery store. My mother left me in the grocery store, like literally forgot me in there while I sat in the aisle and read the book.
John knows exactly what it is. Go ahead, John. What is it?
I don't know the exact issue, but I know the arc. It was Larry Hama, I believe, was writing Wolverine, the monthly series at the time. And Mark Silvestri, I believe, was doing the art. He had left X-Men to go to Wolverine, which at that point was a bigger profile gig. And it was there was a storyline with the a real grotesque sort of cyborg Wolverine named Albert.
Yeah.
And he ran around with a cyborg little girl whose name was Elsie.
Okay.
D. LCD, but it was LCELSIEDDE. Larry Hama, guys. Larry Hama.
I love the 90s.
And Larry Hama names are great. I mean, look at all the G.I. Joe names and stuff, too. So, so I know this era, the White Monster makes me think probably Wendigo.
Yeah, Wendigo, that's what it was.
Yeah, which was, you know, canonically, that was the first appearance of Wolverine, was in a Hulk issue fighting Wendigo. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was the first comic I ever read, and I didn't read a lot of comics, but I could tell you, even from an early age, I've always hated Superman. So, really? Yeah, I've never liked Superman.
You're actually talking to one of the number one Superman fan over here, John.
Yeah. So, side story for you that you will probably appreciate. So I do a lot of conventions now that I write, because I'm indie, so you know that's how you get the book out. If you're not doing a Kickstarter, you're going to conventions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was in Philly last year, and so I'm setting up my table, and there's this older gentleman sits down next to me, and he comes over, and I don't know who anybody is. And he goes, "Hi, my name's Christopher Priest. How you doing?" I was like, "Oh, hey, my name's Dennis Robinson. How you doing?" He's like, "You don't know who I am, do you?" I said, "No idea." Oh, and so man. He just read through his resume, and I was like, I feel like I should probably know who you are. And it was funny because he actually seemed like he liked it more that I didn't know who he was, because he and I shot the shit for 3 straight days, like about all things, politics, life, this and that, writing. And so he talked about how he's I think he's currently writing Superman, or he was, and he was the first black writer on Superman. And we were joking about that. And I was like, wow, that's crazy that you're the first black writer on Superman. I was like, that's probably because he's so damn boring. And he's like, yeah, he's super hokey. He's like, but mine's not boring. I said, okay. And he goes, no, I'm telling you, he doesn't even punch anybody in the book that I wrote. And I was like, all right, I'm interested. And he sent it to me. I actually did like that one because he's like lost in space.
Yep. Yeah.
And he doesn't really have powers that much. And he's just kind of losing his mind and all that stuff. I was like, okay, that I like that.
Yeah, that was Superman Lost. It was I think a 10-issue mini that just finished out. Christopher Priest, or sometimes just known as Priest, original flavor known as Jim Owsley, very long running career in comics. Had a bit of a controversial editorship of Amazing Spider-Man in the 80s, which, you know, again, really more the fault that he was a young editor, I think, thrust into a situation that he probably wasn't experienced enough to understand at the time. Did a great run on Black Panther through the 90s and I think early 2000s. One of my favorite writers, very prolific, really does great character work, definitely understands the characters. And while I haven't read Superman Lost, I've read what he has said about it and what you just said. And yeah, it's one of the challenges, I think, to write a character who can be so powerful, but yet make him interesting. And a lot of it, again, a lot of I like to stress is, you know, these stories that we do, they hinge on the characters. You have to buy into the character to buy into the story. And so, yeah, if somebody just doesn't have a good grasp on any character work and they just try and write Superman, you really get a lot of the goofy stuff from the 50s and 60s, you know, and even into the 70s. Sure. So it's a tough character to write. And yeah, it doesn't necessarily appeal to everybody. And that is a challenge for a writer. I would pull your attention to a miniseries from about 10 or 15 years ago that you might be interested in based on your subject matter that we're going to talk about, called Superman and Batman versus Werewolves and Vampires. I forget who wrote it, but it was illustrated by a really good horror artist who also delves into superhero stuff, Tom Mandrake. I know, you know, kind of like a little hint to what we're going to get at with your story. Sure. But yeah, that's a Superman story you might be interested in, just as far as one of the aspects of that subject matter.
I'll have to check it out. Because I also read, because my I have a friend who used to do a comic podcast, and he would recommend books to me every now and then. So like Dice or Die, I guess it is, read that, loved it. I loved Realm for a while until it stopped making any sense whatsoever, and then I was like, all right, I'm out. And then I really loved The Last God by Philip Kennedy Johnson. Met him a couple times at Baltimore Comic Con. He's actually friends with the friend who used to do a comic podcast. But he recommended also this Marvel storyline where they were fighting vampires.
Yeah.
So it was like Ghost Rider and She-Hulk and Blade. And I forget who else was in that. And yeah, they were fighting vampires and all this stuff, and that was pretty fun.
And those always make for good Superman stories too, because he has a problem with magic and the supernatural.
Yes.
Yeah. So right. He would do terrible in a D&D campaign. No doubt.
And it's funny because I love playing D&D, but anything D&D related, I cannot stand to read. So I didn't read the D&D like comics that come out and stuff like that. I cannot read them. I have to be part of the campaign. I can't read anything about the campaign because I go.
Die I loved because it's very much Jumanji, but like a much darker, messed up Jumanji. I definitely recommend it. The reading realm, I was from a D&D standpoint, because I didn't know what it was about when it was recommended to me. I read it like, oh, that's the rogue. Oh, that's the barbarian. Oh, that's the ranger. I'm like, okay, this is very D&D, but set in a modern world sort of thing.
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff out there like that. I disconnected myself, right? Wait.
No, you're good.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah. Maybe he can't hear us.
Ah, there you go.
Ah, yep. Ah.
Disconnected myself. Kicking away there. All right, cool. So, yeah. So, so not a lot of comic history in your background.
No, not a ton of it.
You took it upon yourself to write a comic.
Yeah.
How do we get there?
So, more than a decade ago, I had this idea for this book about the world's first werewolf, and somewhere, I don't know where in this house, but somewhere, rolled up yellow piece of paper, like of timelines and all these notes that I wrote while I was at Disney World way, way back of this story that I had and all these little ideas. And then I just shelved it and I said, I'm never going to make a comic book. That's not realistic. And then I started doing Botched, and we went to Dragon Con for the first time, and I hung out with a whole bunch of other nerds, and we were talking comics, and I pitched the idea to them, and they're like, yeah, no, you need to make that. And so from that point, I had to figure out how to write a comic. So the first versions of the books were like this weird mutation between a book and a script that, like, it's not good. Like, I don't recommend anyone reading that first version of anything. But it was more to just sort of get the story and figure out where I was going with it. And so I gave it to friends to read, and they would give me feedback on, like, oh, well, like, hey, maybe, like, build on this character more or do this or do that. So I built them out. And then I remember, so through the podcast, I end up having a lot of friends that are all over the place. And one of my friends, I don't know how she knows as many people as she knows, but she used to tour around with Jim Starlin. Like, he used to take her to, like, conventions.
Name dropping, I like it.
I know, right? But, like, she could name drop all day. She, like, knows everybody. And she has, like, all these stories of just hanging out with people. And so I don't know if you're familiar with the writer Henri Kumpen. He does Yi Sun Shin. That's his big series that he's known for. But she had talked to him, and she introduced the two of us, and he put me in touch with his first editor, who read the first versions of my books, and he said, all right, so there's nothing salvageable about these books whatsoever, and you should not do these. And instead, if you pay me $1,800, I will teach you how to write something different that's not these, that's better than that. And I was just like, no, I'm good, thanks. And so I was good. I was ready to give up. And then Shannon pitched the idea directly to Henri. And then Henri reached out and was like, hey, Shannon pitched it to me. I really like the idea. Send me the scripts to take a look at. And he read them. And he said, well, you just don't know what you're doing. Like, there's definitely something here. You've never written a comic script before. So you don't know what you don't know. So he sort of became my mentor. And he taught me, you know, script writing fundamentals of, like, you know, this is how many panels per page, and this is how many captions per panel, and, you know, how it should work and whatnot. And then he gave me a template to go off of. And from there, the first book in the mutant form that I had it, I sort of turned that into the first script. But that in itself was very complicated, because originally my editor, Henri, was like, you know, we can't do a 60-page book for your first book because it's going to be too expensive. So let's do a 24-page book, but not split it into 24. He wanted to make 60 into 24. And I said, there's no way you could do that. Like, he's like, oh, no, we could do it. We could definitely, I'm sure there's a lot of fluff in there, we'll trim it down. And he sent me an outline. I'm like, you literally have characters appearing and dying on the same page. Like, no one's going to give two craps about any of these characters. So instead I decided, let's just take the 60 and split it into two books. And we'll do like a 24-page book and a 24-page book. So I did the 24, and then as the art team started to work on it, they were like, there's too many panels per page. So 24 became 26, and 26 became 28, and 28 became 30. Mm-hmm. And then as we were finishing up the first 30 pages, COVID hit. So the Kickstarter, which was planned, I scrapped for that time because COVID. So then we were aiming for Dragon Con of the following year. Well, by the time that came around, both halves of books were done. Mm. So I said, well, screw it. Just put it back together. And so then instead of doing halves, I just do, you know, full books. So the first book is 60 pages of story with about 12 pages of extras. So that's sort of how the whole thing got started, and then how each book, now each book is, we don't even do halves. It's just however long I want the book to be. That's how long the book's going to be.
Okay. So not your traditional issues.
No, no.
So you pretty much have a trade, because I was talking to you a little bit right before we got on, and I was like, yeah, I was getting ready to hop in there and just do 22 pages and like, ooh, okay, we're moving on. Because you sent us actually two books, and I thought it was going to be two, you know, 22 page books, which are usually like really fast read-throughs. And when I saw 70 something pages, I said, these are trades. So you have full on stories in there.
And the third book's actually 96. So third one's even longer.
So it's quite hefty. And we'll talk about that. But yeah, sure. So all right. So you've got scripts. You got feedback, which is fantastic. Took them, then went through. So it was just the trial and error process for you then, right?
Yeah.
Just going back and forth.
Yeah.
In regards to the script. All right, so now you have your script, because I'm assuming you're just the writer, not the artist, correct?
Yes, there's not enough time in the universe. I get that question at every convention. And I'm like, not the artist.
Listen, there's a guy out there, what is it, DWJ, right? DWJ.
I know they exist, but I have a day job too. These books will come out every decade if I do it all myself.
This is true. This is the life of a neat person, because we all have full-time jobs in the daytime, and then this is stuff that we love to do. All right, so you're the writer. Now you have to put a team together. How do you go about doing that?
So when we first tried to put a team together, this was right before COVID and everything went awry. We were using, Henri was giving me suggestions of like DeviantArt and stuff like that, but you were just getting so many submissions that were just like, I'm very picky when it comes to art. So nothing was really hitting my fancy. And then sort of everything fell by the wayside as we were, you know, getting nearer to COVID. And then through the podcast, we do a lot of fan. It's not, I guess you'd call it fan art. It's basically at Dragon Con, I would go up to artists and be like, hey, would you like to do art for our podcast that we give to our patrons as one of the Patreon tiers?
Cool.
And they're like, oh, yeah. Like, what kind of art? And I'm like, oh, for instance, a cat blimp that's made out of skinned cats and cat bones. And it's manned by cats. And it has a Catlin gun that shoots feral cats at people. And they're like, yes, I want to do this. And so that's how we found a bunch of artists that way. And one of the artists, her name's Cloverkin. She does definitely not that sort of stuff. More, her stuff's like very beautiful watercolor prints and things like that. So, but she was still doing like that very cute and sweet version of our stuff. And her husband is Gabbo, who has been in the comics industry and whatnot. So when I was trying to find an artist, I reached out to her, and then she put me in touch with him. And he said, hey, I'm going to put you in this Facebook group. And I always get the name of the group mixed up, but it's around the lines of connecting writers and artists. And so when you get in there, you have to put a legitimate, you know, post up that says, hey, this is what I'm looking for. This is what I'm paying. This is what I'm doing. You know, serious inquiries only. And immediately the quality of the work that I was getting coming in was way better. And so I started, you know, narrowing things down from there until we got to about, let's say, five artists. And then we started doing tryouts. And then that's how I nailed or landed on the artist Sal Denaire out of Spain. And then the colorist, same sort of thing, except for that one was a little easier. It was down to two colorists. And that decision was really easy because the second colorist didn't bother to respond. So I was like, all right, easy peasy. So his name's Ezequiel Dominguez. He's out of Argentina. And then my letterer actually came over from Henri, Joel Saavedra. He does all the lettering on Henri's books. So Joel made the logo. He made my Hivehead Studios logo. He does all the lettering on the covers and the interior and all that stuff too. So that's sort of how we put the art team together. And we still have the same art team. As far as editing goes, the first half of the first book, Henri was both the writing and art editor, and then he left the project and Gabbo became the art editor. And one of my friends, Stephanie Crugnola, who's also a big podcaster, she has like an English background and writing background. She became my writing editor. And then same team that was on the second book, and then Gabbo left the project. And so now I just sort of do my own art editing, because now I feel like I know what I'm looking for, because I have, you know, two books under my belt. But I still have Steph as the writing editor, just because she's a great sounding offboard. And also I love her reactions as she's making notes going through my script. It makes me laugh a lot when she's like, you're not going to do this thing, are you? Scroll. No, come on. Okay. You did this, but you're not going to keep doing that, right? Scroll. Oh my God, Dennis. Like, seriously? Scroll. I hate you. I hate you so much. And then I get a message after she read the third book script, and she said, I hate it. I hate you. I love it.
Nice. Yeah, I find that most, especially like indie books, definitely benefit from having multiple editors, where you have sort of like this traditional English background, where you have grammar, punctuation being checked on, and then an editor that is familiar with the style of comics medium, because the beats are different than you would have like a movie script, or and sometimes what we have in our head doesn't always translate to the paper, and obviously you're the writer, and what you've written out needs to be translated by the artist, and sometimes that works out great, and other times you're like, what the bloody and I've been on both ends, where I've worked with writers to do stuff, and you know, how many times can you redraw something in the vision of somebody else's head until you get it right? So it can be quite frustrating. So how did you find the relationship between the group? Was the dynamic really good, or did you have struggles?
No, it's been great. So none of the team really interacts with each other so much. It's mostly like I'm the producer of everything. So it's back and forth with me. With the artist, so I give it, the way I write my scripts, it's very, very detailed in terms of like, you know, this is the time of day, this is where the camera is, this is where it's pointed to, this is who's in the shot, this is where they are in the shot, this is their emotion in the shot, you know, all like it's a brick of details that he can then build off of and go on. And sometimes he changes it up the way that I have it, and sometimes he leaves it the same. Usually I'm pretty okay with his changes, because sometimes he'll come up with some really creative stuff. I'm not like so big a stickler that I'm like, no, you got to do it the way that I wrote it. No. If it looks good and I like it, then hey, sweet, I'm fine with it. You know,
nice.
If it doesn't, if I feel like it doesn't work, then yeah, I'll ask him to tweak it or whatever. And there's never any, you know, sort of issues there. But he'll do a sketch of the page first.
Mm-hmm.
And the only issue with that sometimes is that, you know, if it's a super rough sketch, sometimes it's hard to figure out what things are going to look like with all the detail put in.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually most of our back and forth is during the sketch period. And then once that's, you know, got the okay, he'll give me the final version. And then if there are any tweaks that need to be made, we go, you know, we'll make those. Sometimes there's a bit of a language barrier. Like, he speaks English just fine, but sometimes there's like just a little bit of a barrier where he doesn't really understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in the third book, I say this kid is wall running. And if anyone's played Prince of Persia, you know exactly what I mean by wall running. And he just could not understand what I was talking about. And so eventually I will send like pictures and videos and like reference materials to help sort of like, and then he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that makes total sense.
He goes, parkour.
So that sort of thing every once in a while will pop up. With the colorist, usually I don't have too much to tell the colorist. The first time he started doing pages, he did the page and he did it pretty traditional colors, like what it would probably look like. And I said, no, go crazy with it. I want more color. Like, think Aladdin color palette. Like, it's nighttime. Give me blues and purples. And, you know, I get it that it's the desert, but I like a lot of color. So he's like, yeah, let's do color. Okay. And so so he goes crazy with the color. And every once in a while, you know, there'll be something where, like, for instance, in the second book, they had these gems on a necklace. And I said, they look like Christmas lights. Can we change the color on the, because just the colors that he chose. And then as soon as I said, he's like, oh my God, you're right. They do look like Christmas lights.
Yeah.
And then it was an easy fix, you know, just change the colors out.
Yeah.
Usually like real small tweaks and things like that.
Yeah. It's interesting because John and I were having a conversation about this because, you know, the book that we have is black and white. And then you have color books. And I think, honestly, there's challenges in both, like with black and white, because you're taking away the color.
Yep.
You have to pay attention to your line work a lot, and not just the line that you're putting down, but also the negative space, because that actually becomes something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you have colors, you have to think about tone. So it's all right, I want to have all these colors, but what's the actual tone of the book?
Yeah.
And I think what people don't realize is that when they're not just reading and they're looking at the art that there's a visceral response or not, to what you're reading. So that can be an enhancement and connection to what you're reading, or there could be a complete disconnect. And I know that we read a couple of books last year, and that was one of the things that threw me off in a couple of books that we read. And I had mentioned that this book was, the way that it read was not the way that it was visually laid out. So that for me, it was a disconnect. And it doesn't have to be like that for everybody, but
sure.
I just found it for myself. In that respect. So yeah, so a lot of the color palette that was chosen in here for certain things were, it was pretty spot on with, mm-hmm. I think, sort of like the tone that you were trying to create, or what I had created in my head from what I was reading, which was pretty cool. And I know assembling a team, and it is hard to begin with, but I think we're in an age and time where we have access to the world. And it was, yep. Interesting for you to say that, you have these people from, Argentina, because I work with people because I work with multicolorists, and I work with from, Brazil, all the way even to Africa and stuff like that as well. Yeah. And they're just fantastic. They're just, click onto the keyboard, get onto your Wi-Fi, and all of a sudden you're connected to all these resources, which is fantastic. So
yeah.
it's amazing, how modern technology has allowed the growth of, not just the comics medium, but the indie comic movement, we'll call it. Just because, in the old days, you even go back to the creation of characters like Superman and Batman, it's you got a guy who wrote, and he knew an artist. It was like his buddy, his roommate, or whatever. Let's do this together. If you didn't have an artist, you taught yourself how to draw. And that was very much, through the what I call the indie comic silver age of the 80s, and the 90s too. And so to have the internet be used as a tool to connect writers and artists from across the globe to collaborate on projects like this, because I definitely think that, and I want to get in a little bit about what I some of the stuff I found in your work, but I think it benefits from having a diverse group of creators from across the world, because you're not telling a story set in modern day America.
Yeah.
You're telling a story that spans centuries and in other countries.
Yeah.
So I think bringing in that sensibility as the authenticity of what's on the page.
Yeah. It's funny. One of the artists that was trying out originally, so the setting of the book, and one of the first artists that tried out, he had like a square jawline. It was like the whitest guy ever. Like I was like, this isn't set. It's not American. Like, what are you doing? He's got like a buzz cut and all that. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Sometimes they just miss the mark on that.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So then you've got your team together. So now this is where it gets really important, because most people who are looking to, make their first comic, have like the sparkle in their eye. I've got a pencil, I've got paper, I've got a team. Shit, I don't have money. How the fuck am I going to get this out there to the world? So did you know that you wanted to get this out there? Or was this just, a project for yourself, or...
No, I wanted to get it out there, because one of the questions I get sometimes is like, so why'd you do a comic? Like, why didn't you just do like a regular book? And the reason is, when I read anything, usually, especially books, when I'm reading something, I visualize it in my head a specific way. And with these, I didn't want people to be able to do that. I wanted people to visualize it the way that I see it in my head, as opposed to letting them sort of like figure it out on their own. So that's why I wanted to do a comic. And with the podcast, I love storytelling and that sort of thing. So I really wanted to get the book out there. And I thought, because I have a little bit of a podcast audience, and I have some experience with conventions and sales and stuff like that, it'd be at least something to try and, give it a shot. And it is very expensive, especially when you're the writer, aka the cheapest man on the team. So I do Kickstarters, I go to shows, and that helps sort of recoup some of the costs, because I pay everything out of pocket.
Okay.
I don't have kids aside from a dog. So I don't have a ton.
It's expensive, because I have one as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got a newfie. She's 116 pounds. And yeah, no, she can get pricey sometimes.
Yeah, no, I got a Yorkie who's, eats like she's 160 pounds.
There you go.
Yeah. But all right. So that's interesting, because most creators don't realize that, especially now, we're getting into an age and this would be more of a modern age for what it is that we're doing, because we were talking about sort of like the golden era of indie comics into like the Silver Age. And this would be sort of like that modern era where we have access to a ton of tools. And I think there's a flood in the market with material as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you already said it, you know, having to shift through all these different creators that were coming to you for their work. And there's a lot out there. So you start at Deviant and you're completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And half the time it's, you know, and it's funny because like almost every day when I'm checking our account on Instagram, I've got like 10 to 15 messages of, hey, I'm an artist. Can you check my art out? I'd love to do some stuff. And it's like two stick figures. I'm like, you gotta be fucking kidding me.
I get those messages every once in a while, but I'm like, I don't need anybody right now, but yeah, I appreciate it.
No, and kudos to them for, you know, trying to reach out and stuff like that. You know, half the time I think it's just bots.
Could
but
be.
It's not, holy shit. But there's stuff that's readily accessible to us, which sure. is fantastic. But at the same time, it can be quite overwhelming because there's so much out there. So it's just bonkers. But most creators don't realize that it does. And oftentimes when they're trying to create teams, they're banking on the Kickstarter to be funded to be able to pay their team afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's a really big, huge commitment. Yeah. For something that may or may not happen. So the only way that I would say go ahead and do that is if you have tens of thousands of followers who are going to support your project and you know, being this from the get-go. But most of the time, I think it's going to be done the way that you've done it. And we've done it. We complete the project 100% before we even put it onto a crowdfunding campaign, because I've supported a bunch of crowdfunding campaigns. And at times, I'm like, you know, 10, 20 campaigns deep. And then like 3 years down the road, I get a book. I'm like, holy shit.
I forgot all about it. Yeah, that happens all the time where I'm like, when did I back a board game? Like 4 years ago, right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's insane. So being able to, and now with, you know, so much being out there, the more readily accessible that it can be, I think it's, you'll have a greater return as well. And I think one of the things that you did that was really smart as well is the amount of content that you were able to give in one shot. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people still doing single issues out there without having, you know, a full art completed to be able to get it out. And it makes it really hard when you have, you know, issue one and then issue two doesn't come out for 6 months. Yep. In that time, you've read how much and how much have you forgotten about that initial book?
Yeah.
So as much as when I opened it up, I said, holy shit, 77 pages. It was good because there was enough content in there to say, oh, there's an actual story here, and then you being able to continue it on and stuff like that, which is great. That's my two cents on that for you guys. So if you're thinking about actually doing a book, do something that's gonna kind of be meaty out there, and
there's
have to money to pay your artist.
There's a book that was shared with me, which is why I started doing it, because originally my idea was do a Kickstarter to raise the money to then pay for the production. But somebody shared this book with me, and I can't remember the person's name, but he made Code Monkey Saves the World, and like all of his Kickstarters for every comic he's done like are huge. And so he wrote a book on making a Kickstarter for a comic book. And so I read through, somebody was kind enough to give it to me, and I read through it. And one of the first things he says, if you do not have an audience, your book needs to be done before you even do the Kickstarter. Which is expensive, but it is what it is, because people have a hard time trusting things on Kickstarter because they get burned all the time. I mean, I've gotten burned a couple of times. There was one where the guy was making an RPG, and then he said, after he'd gotten all the money, he said, nah, I'm going to go do a wrestling thing instead, and just took the money and ran and never did the RPG. And he had like four projects that had completed at the same time, and he just took all that money and just ran. So I definitely get the horror stories and things like that. So that I wanted to have the book all the way done before the Kickstarter happened. So the first book, all the way done when the Kickstarter happened. Second book, all the way done when the Kickstarter happened. The third book won't be completely done by the time the Kickstarter launches. The book is 75 out of 90 pages drawn right now, and then it's about halfway colored, and then it's a little bit less lettered on that. So it'll be done. I mean, at this point, I'm in too deep, but you know, it's just a matter of, it won't be done all the way up, you know, when the Kickstarter launches, which is fine. Cause everybody takes so long to respond to their surveys anyways, that, you know, it buys me a little extra time in.
Yeah. No, that's good. All right, cool. Yeah, so let's dive into the actual book then. So give us some backstory on Lycan, because Solomon's Odyssey.
Sure. So the elevator pitch that I always give to everybody at conventions is that Lycan Solomon's Odyssey is the story of the world's first werewolf, and it's a mix of horror, adventure, mythology, and a little bit of history. So it's sort of like an alternate telling of what actually happened in our history, but from a mythological standpoint. Mm. So the first book in the series starts, in 8000 BC in what is today Saudi Arabia, so like Mesopotamia, that sort of thing. And then each book in the series moves a little bit further through time and goes into different regional monsters and mythologies. It's still Solomon. That's the main thread through each of the books, but he sort of moves around and he's an immortal character. So as he moves from book to from place to place, he sort of experiences all these different things. So the first book is the setup. It's the origin story. And then the second book in the series starts to open things up in terms of dealing with PTSD and loss and depression, but also opening things up to magic and things of that nature and going into ancient Arabic mythology and folklore. And then the third book, which comes out in March, the way I describe that is H.P. Lovecraft meets Gilgamesh.
Mm. Okay. I could dig it.
And how many books all told? Is this going to be three books? Do you want to bring
15.
This? 15 total.
So I know what happens all the way up to the last page of the 15th.
That's amazing. That's great. And
so, right, so that was the other. Oh, I'm sorry, John.
Oh, yeah.
But that was the other thing that is really important as well. Is that no? Go ahead, John. I'm not going to ruin it.
Go. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, it's more just like, wow, that's cool. Like, so bringing Solomon to the modern age, as far as.
The last book in the series will be set in a little bit into the future, not like flying cars future, okay. But just like, you know, maybe a couple decades into the future or something.
Very
like
cool.
That.
Very cool. All right. So yeah, cool. Your point, Angel. What are you
gonna... No. So I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I swear to God, I think it was the Todd father that had made this quote. Todd father is Todd McFarlane.
Sure.
And he was like, when you're writing a story, it doesn't matter if it's one issue, 1,000 issues, just know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to end at book 15. It could end at book 30 or 35.
Sure.
Just know what the ending is going to be and then create a story or journey that gets to there.
Yeah.
The fact that you know that it's already 15 books, holy shit, that's impressive. So, and when we try to do these with, you know, when we have creators on, we're always trying to educate new creators as well. And I think if there's going to be any takeaway today, there's a couple things actually, because you're doing things right, which is, you know, you've got your team that you create. Well, you got your concept. You got feedback. Didn't say fuck you to the feedback. Took it.
You know, yeah.
And then got help. And it's really important for, especially as creators, I think, yeah, because even I think more so writers and artists, whenever they get feedback, it's often taken to heart. And they're like, fuck you, you have no idea what you're talking about because I know what I have in my head kind of thing. And I think a lot of creators need to let that go to the wayside. Take what they can as far as feedback. Use whatever they can from that feedback and discard what doesn't work for them.
Yeah.
And then move on to the next phase, which is what you did. You got the help that you needed. You got refinement and you put a team together. And then you went into your own pockets, got this thing made, and then went on to Kickstarter and got support from there as well. So there's a really good solid formula for anybody who's thinking about doing this to start there. But at the same time, even before you even get there, I got a story in my head, just know where it's going. Know where the ending is. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter how many pages it takes to get to that ending, just know what's going to happen to that character at the very end. And whether it comes or not in 10 to 15, 20 years, look at Todd. I mean, you got Spawn in 1992 and it's 2024. We're going on to issue 350. And I only go back to him because he was the first comic that I ever bought with my own money.
Okay.
16 years old, went in there, $1.95, my own money. And I still have that book to this day. So, Todd, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the podcast.
And to speak to one of the things you said about the criticism. So in the long, long, long ago of 2006, I went to art school for a wee little bit of time. And one of the first things they teach you is, like, you need to be able to accept constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. Now, there are different types of criticism. Mm-hmm. If they're being a dick, they're a dick. But like, if they're being constructive in the criticism, like, take that and use it. And so early on with that, like they beat you over the head with that, like, you're going to be criticized. If you want to be able to do anything in life, art or otherwise, you need to be able to take criticism and then incorporate that and grow from it. So that's what I've always done. So, you know, if anybody, you know, has any comments about the books or stuff like that, I'm always ears. I'm like, hey, if there's a way I can make it better, I'm all ears. I'm more than happy to try and make it better. Same thing with the podcast or anything else that I do. You know, normal day job is the exact same thing. So, yeah, so that's one of those things where it's not just for art and comics. It works for everything. Like, right, be open to accepting criticism and then growing from it, so that way you can just constantly get better.
Yeah, no, that's good. And especially if it kind of meshes with, you know, your actual ideas of what it is for the book that's going on there, which is great. And oftentimes getting some of that feedback, if it's spot on, where yeah, they're getting you and they're yeah, getting the story, then you know that you're moving in the right direction. So with that being said, I mean, I didn't get through the whole thing just because sure, I was like, holy shit. and it's, you know, if for an origin, and I, that's one of the things, all right, so this is what I will say. One of the things that I appreciate was there's a lot of material in this first book. So if you're going to get this, guys, you're definitely going to get your money's worth because there's a lot in here. And I think that one of the things that I really appreciated, especially when you have more than 22 pages to tell the story, is how much time yeah, you have to tell that story. And I was like, I was reading it and I was like, four pages, you know, X amount of pages, there was a small side story being told, and it was more about character development mm-hmm, and sort of like relationship building. And I think it was really clever in the sense of, all right, you're building these characters because you want me to have some type of attachment, because this motherfucker is going to die something and it's going to destroy me later on. And that was cool. And I really liked that. And I think sometimes that stuff, we don't have enough time for it, but it is also like what happens in between the gutter spaces. So that gutter space between the panels often tells you a lot as well. Mm-hmm. But you took the stuff that was in the gutter panels and you kind of expanded it out with your writing and that story. So I've not seen that in a while, because oftentimes when I'm reading comics, and it's funny because most comics now don't even have gutters because they're just like splash pages of panels on top of panels. Oh, yeah. And it irritates my soul. But if you look at traditional comics and you have that space in between, that's that pause, and that's when your brain takes over and fills in with imagery what's happening from scene to scene. And you kind of took that on its head and expanded it out into pages so that I didn't have to think that much about what was in there, which was cool. I think the color palette that you chose too, between the night and the day, I think your colorist is spot on with the tone that you were setting in this particular book as well. So I appreciated that. One of the things that most people don't realize that they need is a good letterer or letterist. Mm-hmm. They're an artist onto themselves.
Yeah.
So they actually make the words have not only meaning, but sort of like you get that visceral response. Are they screaming? Are they scared? Are they yelling? Are they angst? Are they worried? And oftentimes it's a combination of whether the artist can portray that in the visuals, mm-hmm, as well as what the letterist is doing with the words. And I thought there was a solid job with, you know, the letters, because you had a lot to say.
So that was one of the things Priest said. He's like, he opened the book because he did buy it. And he opens the book and he goes, okay, less is more. You don't need to have so many words. I was like, I know. I got better with that each book. That's the first book I was very wordy. I get it.
Yeah, but you know what? What's his face? Scott Snyder. Like, his first issues are wordy mm-hmm, as hell, because there's just so much background information, sure, especially when he's doing new things and you're world building. It almost makes sense. And there's like, you're trying to find that right, you know, formula of yeah, how many words can I give and how much, because it is a visual medium.
Yeah.
So you didn't want people to read a book. You want them yeah, to see it at the same time.
Yeah.
So how much time do you want them in their thinking space? And then how much time do you want them in their experience space? But for it being the first book, I think it needed sort of like that background. As soon as I get through it and get into the second one, I want to see if there is sort of like a diminishing of the panels or the words to let more of the art and story be told. Because it is
the truth. Can I speak to something you said about the letter?
Yeah.
So there's something. So this is something I learned in working through with my letter that he showed me, which is he was showing me how when he builds out the captions, it's specifically to make the reader's eye travel on a specific path mm-hmm. around from panel mm-hmm. to panel. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I never thought about it that way. And he's just like, yeah. So like part of what I'm doing is not just sticking bubbles in, you know, panels or whatever, but like literally like taking the reader on like a journey through the panels. And I thought that was so neat the way that he had explained it to me. And part of the other thing the letterer does is he will straight up tell me like, you need to get rid of like a caption. Like, I don't want to cover up this art. This art's amazing.
Yeah.
Like cut down one, get rid of one of them. I don't know what you got to do. We get rid of one. And then I'll go back with my editor and be like, okay, how do we get across the same point, but with one less caption, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We don't really have that as much for the second or the third book. It was that first book that it really popped up a lot.
Yeah. But yeah, that was something that I did notice that the letter did a great job of carrying your eye across the page. You know, every now and then you get something, you know, not in your book, I'm saying in the other books,
sure,
where there's an isolated word balloon floating in the corner. And it's like, well, that placement probably could have been a little clearer elsewhere. Sure. But, you know, so I really, that was especially for something that, you know, it is massive, but it is not unwieldy. And I think part of that reading experience is it's easy to read. It carries your eye through. Mm. Everything is clear. I love that you allow the story to breathe, allow these characters to be fully realized characters. It is heartbreaking at times, but there's also a lightness and a sense of humor, especially with your lead character as he's mm-hmm. going through all of this, that I found very engaging. And I love that you spent that time, especially in the first issue, to do all of this world building, only to just completely tear that world apart by the end of it, because that was stunning and that was fantastic. Spoilers. Well, I mean, but again, just to start that journey in that way, I thought was fantastic. I do have a couple questions.
Sure.
So I get the sense clearly you are a student of history. You very much like.
I do. Okay, yeah. Love mythology. Like, love mythology. That's also what got me into this sort of thing. Loved werewolves since I was a little kid.
Right.
And I randomly stumbled across Lon Chaney's Wolfman. But then in high school, I guess it was, the first God of War came out. And like, I love God of War. It got so bad with God of War that I'd go to museums like for school trips and like I would be able to answer like every question about Greek mythology. And she was like, you played God of War, didn't you? I was like, yes, I did. She's like, you guys, there's always one on a tour. Then from with Botched, one of the seasons we did was 1932 New York City and like a Cthulhu sort of thing. But the reason I picked New York City is that it's a melting pot of all these different ethnicities. So they bring in with them all of their mythology. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting like Slavic mythology and Japanese mythology and Chinese mythology and all this stuff. So I got to do all this research on all these different monsters and stuff. And I was like, this is like, there's so many fascinating like deities and creatures like all throughout time and history, but like nobody ever talks about them. Most of what you get is Norse or Greek or, you know, stuff like that. You don't really get like all the crazy, like, do you know what a Leshy is?
No.
A Leshy is one of the goofiest monsters. It will tickle you to death. Literally, it's like a plant monster. It like has a fairly friendly looking demeanor, but it literally will tickle you to death. And the way you combat the Leshy is you have to put your clothes on backwards and your shoes on the opposite feet and he won't bother you. Okay. Like just like weird, crazy crap like that. I just find fascinating that it's just all over the place that you just never hear about it.
So clearly the inn was mythology, specifically werewolves, your fascination with werewolves. And then the idea to sort of set it, as you did, with the origin of the werewolf, the first werewolf, and then take this journey through history, I think gives this something that a lot of other things, you know, in the horror realm don't necessarily have, is that this could, you know, yeah, you got a kick-ass werewolf story, doesn't hold back, it is visceral and violent and gory, and it really scratches that itch, there's no doubt.
Sure.
But the historical aspect of it is very precise. I know, you know, the artist has to do a lot of research and legwork on there, and you do as well.
Well, so actually with the art team, I would supply them with all the reference materials. They would say like, hey, give me references. So I would look up the different, I mean, as much information as you can get from pre-written history anyways, but like the different like hut styles and the clothing types and the tools and all that stuff. And like, you know, what type of agriculture and things like that did they have at that time? And like, I would send him all that. And I do that for each book. I send them all these reference materials and that's how we build everything up.
Yeah.
That way. So yeah, no, it's a ton of research. And then as I get into written history with the books, because I just last year I wrote the fourth book, which is set in ancient Egypt. Okay. Well, now that you got written history, well, now there's a lot less room for error. So so there's a lot of research and like mapping out like, okay, can you see this from here? All right, let's pull it up on the map. You can probably see that from there. Okay.
And I think that that aspect is a great hook. And I think it's a great way to help you move some paper outside of the horror werewolf crowd, because this is something that, you know, could easily be used as a way to illustrate history and how societies have progressed over time. Again, with a really cool kick-ass werewolf story as part of it. So, I mean, again, I hope that that aspect that you built into it, whether it was intentional or not, I really hope it helps you move paper and really get this into hands of academia outside of just, you know, comic people and werewolf and mythological people. Because I think you have something really neat, really special here. And the fact that you are planning 15 of these, that is really just going to cover the course of history, I think is such a great aspect that you just have built into there.
Thank you.
Hundreds of pages coming our way.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, and unfortunately, each book keeps getting a little longer. So
how's like, your health?
what's this health? So, like, The reason it's 15, so my idea is like there's three major arcs and each arc is five books. So like the only thing that I've written like all the way out before, which is those mutant scripts, is the first five chapters. So like, as I said, the fourth book is set in ancient Egypt and then the fifth book is ancient Greece, because obviously I got to do Greece. I mean, come on now. That one I call the Greek Avengers, because, you know, get to pull all these cool characters from Greek mythology and have them all together in this team and go into like, you know, doing this and that without spoiling anything. Yeah. But then in the second arc, that's when, you know, we go to Asia and I want to kind of do my take on Journey to the West with Wukong and stuff like that. Kind of want to get into that and some Buddhism as well. And then go into Mongolian culture as well. I want that arc to end in England, like London or France during like the bubonic plague. Like, so that's sort of like where that is going as well. And then building up like otherworldly things as well. And then the last arc goes more into the Americas. So you get a little bit of South America. I definitely want to touch on Native American culture. And then we get into, I live in Gettysburg, so obviously I have to do the Civil War or like something tied into the Civil War, maybe a little Wild West, because I do love Westerns as well. And then I was thinking, you know, setting it a little bit in like World War, you know, II, something like that for one of the books, and then finishing it out sort of like modern day.
Nice.
One last thing. As far as the origin of the werewolf mythology, how much of that is from established lore, and how much have you created from whole cloth?
So I just made it myself. So the reason I set it in 8000 BC, and like on the back of the book, because every time I go to a convention, there's usually a few people that stop and they're like, so is this like Saint Christopher, or is this King Lycan? And I'm like, nope. So on the back of the book, it literally says, who was the first werewolf? And it names out each one of those like people. It's like, nope, it's way before that. So I set it in 8000 BC. So I go way before anything that's already like written and considered the first. So that way I could do my own version of the story.
Very cool.
And technically in this universe, my plan is eventually that all the werewolves you see in all versions of pop culture, they all exist in the same universe too. So like, you know, you got your Lon Chaney Wolfman, that type of werewolf's in here. You got your American Werewolf in London, that kind of werewolf's in this universe too. Like all that stuff exists in the same universe, but it's like a spectrum the way I see it. Like you got all the way wolf on one side and then all the way dude on the other side. And then, you know, kind of my character's almost dead center in the middle.
Could we see an intercompany crossover with Amazing Action Comics and Project Shadowweed, Merrick?
Well, because he's a werewolf as well. We never know. All right, so two things. One, all right. So the language. So you wrote it in contemporary language, which I appreciate. Sure. Because whenever I read Thor, I'm like, fuck the D and the Thou and or Conan, like traditional Conan. It just takes me out of it. Reading Sumerian and stuff like that. Is that something that's going to stay throughout, or are you bringing context and language in when you're going to these different places like Egypt, Greece?
So the one thing that I try and avoid, and my editor's very good at picking these out, is trying to avoid modern words or modern turns of phrase. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, they're like, it's still told in like a modern-esque language, but it's not like, he's not going to say, well, I can't think of a thing off the top, but he's not going to mention
Solomon. Pill. You got some Riz, like, yeah, that's not going to
like that. He's not going to say that. He's not going to say like, oh, catch it on the boob tube or something like that. Like that stuff doesn't exist, so it doesn't make any sense to, you know, say that sort of thing in the time period. But yeah, I definitely didn't want to try and figure out like how did they speak back then? Because then you get mired down in all the muck of, like you were saying with Thor. Okay, well, then it becomes more difficult to read. I don't want it to be difficult to read. I want it to be easy to digest, and I don't want people to get, now I know some people will probably get hung up on that and be like, well, come on, they're not going to say fuck in 8000 BC, that word wasn't invented until, you know, such and such. It's like, I get it, but like, there's no, I kind of feel like it's a middle ground of like, it's modern but it's not too modern, and it's like traditional but not too traditional, where it's easy to read, it's easy to digest, but it still gives you enough of a feel where you feel like familiar enough with the language that it's not completely foreign to you.
We're extremely familiar with those people. And you know what we say to those people? We say comics. That's all you have to say. It's comics. Anything can happen. All right. Second. So you have the werewolf.
Sure.
Mythos. Will we see any vampires or Frankensteins or creatures from the Black Lagoon? Kind of.
Great. So definitely vampires. Vampires don't pop. Well, technically, the third book kind of has vampires, but not the traditional kind. But the actual main mythos for it, because I am going to do the origin of vampires as well. Okay. And I'm going to do that in the second arc of books. So each of these arcs has, so that there's the main villain overall, Morris, from the first book. And then there's usually a secondary villain that's also throughout that arc. And then sometimes each book has an individual villain, so they're like tertiary villains. But so the vampire is definitely going to be like one of the main secondary villains of the second arc of books.
Okay. And does Mars have an origin as well? Is that
so? Yes, that'll be in the second arc as well, where we're going to go into more like in the third book, for instance. There's a couple time or the second book, there's a couple little nuggets here and there where they kind of talk about these like hints of the type of origin. And the third book also, again, these little hints. And that's sort of how it goes for a bit until in the second arc of books, there's a book specifically devoted to Morris's backstory, where he comes from, the people, and that sort of a thing. It's sort of like building out that, fleshing out that character even more, so that the audience like really gets an idea of like what's the motivation of this character, what's driving them, that sort of a thing.
See, John, we almost got him to spill it, almost. Not quite there. Yeah, I mean it's fascinating what you've been able to accomplish, what you're trying to accomplish, and you know, I think what you will accomplish, which is really crazy. I'm looking forward to actually finishing off this one and the second one, and then showing some love and support for that third one that you got coming up.
I appreciate it.
Now the third book that you have coming out, you're launching your Kickstarter in
March 31st.
Awesome. So we're going to get all the details, guys, and it's going to be in a note. So that way, if you want to go and support Dennis and his project, and can they pick up the first two books?
Yes. So you could go to my web. If you wanted to pick the books up right this second, you can go to my website, Hivehead Studio, like Beehive, hiveheadstudios.com. And there's a store on there. You can buy them digitally. If you just do digital books, you can buy them physically. If you do that, you can actually pick up the first 18 pages of the first book digitally for free as a sample to see if it's like even something you'd be interested in. And then if you wanted to get it in the Kickstarter, there's a tier that's like a catch-up tier that has all three of the books, plus a little cute, adorable, grotesque mini print that my friend made that is just sort of like a bonus thrown in there. Or if you wanted to get one of the other tiers, you could do that and then add the other two books on as add-ons. You could do that too.
Cool.
Or you could somehow track me down at a convention and get them there too, I suppose.
So you're still doing a tour. What's your next convention? Do you know?
It's GalaxyCon Richmond.
Galaxy Con Richmond. That's, okay, cool.
I think it's the first or second week of March, and then Awesome Con in DC is also in March.
Okay. Yes, yes. I've been down there when Awesome Con's going on, and it goes crazy down there. There's also, I don't know what the name of it is, but I know I just filled out a form for it, because I think it's sometime in March or April, but it's an actual just indie con, where it's nothing but indie creators, and I want to say it's in the Massachusetts area, but I could be completely wrong.
Okay.
So I'm gonna try to get info on it, and then if I can find it, I'll send it out to
you. Sure, I appreciate it.
There's more of these, you know, just independent cons, which is just taking whatever, you know, creators have out there and just giving them a platform to be able to share it with other people. So rather than just being part of like the mainstream stuff and pop culture, there's sort of like this underground thing that's just kind of, you know, coming to the forefront, which is not going to be underground anymore. It's just going to be mainstream. It's just crazy how we go from, you know, these extremities of underground to mainstream. All right, cool. John, do you have anything else before I ask the last question?
No, this is great. I mean, again, keep up with it. I really hope you get these 15 out. This is such a really good, engaging story and a unique approach to the werewolf mythology. So more power to you. Again, I don't think you set out to do edutainment, but I also think it fits within that realm as well. So I really, like I said, I want you to move paper on this, and I hope this gets into as many people's hands as possible.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, really cool stuff. And guys, like I said, all the details on how to support the Kickstarter, as well as get your hands on the books and maybe some social media links. And you D&D fans will get that link as well to the podcast. It'll be in the notes as well. All right, last and final question is, what advice, since you've already been on this journey, would you give to any new creators thinking about doing their own creation? What advice would you give them when they're trying to do what you've done?
First advice, which I wouldn't say is the main thing, but if you can do the whole thing yourself, I really recommend going that route to save yourself a lot of financial hardship. But that's not really wide advice, because not everybody can do that. I have met a few people. There was a guy, it's a total side note. I can't remember his name for the life of me. He does like African mythology comics, and he was the writer. And then he looked at how much it cost to pay an artist. So he was like, he taught himself how to draw. So then he drew it. And then he's like, well, how do I, then he taught himself to ink. Then he taught himself to color. Then he taught himself to like letter. So he just does the whole, and then he taught himself to animate. So he turned it into an animated thing. So literally, like, if you could do that, man, more power to you. I am so jealous. But if you are like me, the biggest thing I say in all walks of life, regardless if you are a comic person trying to get into this or not, networking, networking, networking. Mm. And that's, you know, going to conventions and just talking to people. The one thing I say is, if you network with the intention of trying to use somebody, people smell that from a mile away and it won't go anywhere. Instead, just build relationships, like just make friends, you know, make small talk at first, and then sort of just slowly build up relationships. And then, in fact, you know, do them a favor. And then, you know, usually if you need something, they will come to you and say like, hey, I saw that you're doing this thing. You'd be more than happy to help. Or you just get information, or they know somebody who knows somebody. That's how, you know, I found my entire art team. I wasn't friends directly with Gabbo. I was friends with his wife, and she put me in touch with him. And then he put me in touch, you know, with that Facebook group. So with networking, you literally never know what it's going to turn into. And that's literally how everything sort of keeps rolling for me at this point. With each Kickstarter, you know, when I'm going to conventions, I'm networking with the other booths that are nearby, with, you know, other creators, like, oh, this person makes this, or this person makes that. I think this would be a cool item to include in a Kickstarter. And then I start talking to them and like trying to work something out, where it's like, hey, would you be willing to do this for me? And then we can, you know, do this together, that kind of a thing. So for instance, that we're going to have crochet werewolves in the next Kickstarter, because I see so many crochet vendors at conventions and everybody loves it. And when I'm at conventions and I talk about the crochet werewolves, they're like, oh, I could get a crochet werewolf. I was like, yes, you can. You can get a crochet werewolf. So
people love one of those things.
Yeah. So,
That's you know what, that's honestly, that's really good advice, because this is a small community. It's a lot smaller than most people think, and bad travels a lot, you know, farther and faster than good does. So and in short, what Dennis was saying is, don't be a dick.
It's actually, have you ever been to Dragon Con?
I haven't.
It's the one rule of Dragon Con: don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Because literally, if someone catches you being a dick, they take your badge and you can't get into any buildings. So
I love it. I love it. All right, so I'm going to have to try that out. All right, Dennis, listen, it was a blast to have you on. We wish you the best, and we definitely love to have you on maybe after the Kickstarter, you know, launches, and
sure,
you know, when you got see what's going on and then what's going on with the next book. So yeah, best of luck to you on that. Awesome stuff, bro.
Thank you so much. It was a great time being on the show. I had a great time.
Yeah, keep up the great work. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, guys, that's our show for today. So remember, if you like what you heard, you want to click subscribe to the podcast, visit us at AmazingActionComics.com for everything that we've got going on there. If you're a creator like Dennis or just love to talk comics and want to come onto the podcast, AmazingActionComics.com/podcast, fill out the form. John and I would love to have you on. Yeah, so until next time, kiddies, please be amazing, stay amazing, and read something amazing.